Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. So writes J.R.R. Tolkien in a letter to a Jesuit priest, a fact that is becoming increasingly well known, that Tolkien was in fact himself a devout Catholic. In another letter, he adds that he intended the Lord of the Rings to be consonant with Christian thought and belief, and that the Lord of the Rings is about God and his sole right to divine honor. In fact, I teach a course on Tolkien, and the theme of the course is what he meant when he says, Lord of the Rings is a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. That's sort of the goal of the course, is to flesh out what he means by that. Because what could he have meant by these remarks, especially since the term God, nor certainly Catholic, nowhere appear in the story? These remarks have befuddled many scholars over the years. What's specifically Catholic about the Lord of the Rings? While it's not at all obvious, and much of it, in fact, nearly all of it, is beneath the surface, the entire Catholic worldview, I would argue, is present in the Lord of the Rings. All the essential elements of Catholic doctrine are found there. God and the Trinity are there. Christ is there. The Eucharist and all the sacraments are there. The Church is there. The Virgin Mary and the saints are there. The Catholic view of the human person is there, along with all essential elements of Catholic moral doctrine: sin, grace, divine providence, natural law, virtue, both natural and theological. The Catholic view of the last things, the eschaton, is there, and so much of the Bible is there. To see this, though, I think one needs to understand the faith from the inside, for which reason most scholars haven't figured out what Tolkien means by this. So, obviously, I don't have time to flesh all this out, and really all I can do is scratch the surface. But what I propose to do is to explore how some of the things that are present in The Lord of the Rings, especially the more salient structural themes that undergird The Lord of the Rings, how these are Catholic. First, a couple of provisos. The expressly Christian or Catholic dimension of many of the themes might not have been consciously so on Tolkien's part. That's not how a Catholic imagination always works. And that's really what we're talking about, a Catholic imagination, namely by conscious interpolation. Tolkien's imagination was formed by many factors: early 20th century rural England, Norse mythology, especially the Finnish tale Kalevala, Germanic languages, specifically Welsh, Finnish, and the remnants of 4th century Gothic, his experience in the trenches of World War I, and so on. But at the top of the list sits, I would say, his Catholic faith. Sometimes he might consciously draw upon his faith, but oftentimes elements of the faith probably came out in ways he wasn't necessarily aware of. Biblical imagery is present all throughout The Lord of the Rings, if for no other reason than that Tolkien's mind was so saturated with biblical images, personages, events, that they inevitably colored and helped shape many of the images, personages, and events that he created. The biblical notion of kingship, for instance, was so stamped on Tolkien's mind and imagination that he couldn't but bear traces of it. He couldn't but have it in mind, both consciously and subconsciously, when creating the kingship of Aragorn or the stewardship of Lord Denethor. There are all kinds of parallels between Lord Denethor and King Saul, first king of Israel, as recounted in the first book of Samuel, for instance. Second, Tolkien expressed an avowed dislike for allegory, preferring instead what he called applicability and real history. He disliked allegory because he thought it gave the author too much power and control to impose the meaning of the story upon the reader and consider how inordinate power and control is at the heart of the story of The Lord of the Rings. Applicability, on the other hand, gave more freedom to the reader to see multivalent layers of meaning that are applicable to things that the author maybe did or did not necessarily intend or have in mind, such as to the Bible. So we might call it a kind of loose allegory, not a hard and fast allegory that's at play. when identifying the Catholic elements of the Lord of the Rings, we must be careful, I would suggest, to speak of echoes, resonances, parallels, resemblances, rather than of intentional allegory or symbolism, which touches on how Tolkien views the nature of myth-making, or today what we call fantasy or science fiction. Tolkien called it fairy stories. You can find his philosophy of myth-making or science fiction in his essay called On Fairy Stories, which I'd highly recommend that you read. At the end of this essay, Tolkien makes clear that he thinks all the great stories of Western literature, the great myths or fairy stories, think Homer, Virgil, etc., insofar as they contain good and true elements, are but echoes, shadows of what he considers the supreme fairy story, the Christian story. This story is supreme, and it is true. That is, the Christian story is the supreme fairy story because it belongs not in the secondary world of make-believe, but in the primary world of man's history. From this perspective, then, any fairy story that contains anything that is true and good, such as you find in Virgil or Homer, or reveals what Jordan Peterson calls the underlying hierarchical fundamental structure of reality, which is what Jordan Peterson says is the principal merit of myths, all this could be considered a fundamentally Catholic work. It was this theme that converted C.S. Lewis, by the way, when Tolkien had a conversation with him about it. Legend and history have met and fused, Tolkien asserts at the very end of this essay. The Evangelium, that is the Christian gospel, has not abrogated legends. It has hallowed them, especially the happy ending. In other words, God, knowing what echoes in the heart of man, what the human spirit yearns for, such as we see in the classics of Western literature, God makes all of this come true in the way that only God can. And of course, it's recounted in the Bible. Should we be surprised that he considers his own fairy story of the Lord of the Rings as an echo of the Christian story along with all the other stories, especially since, by his own admission, he infused the Lord of the Rings with, quote, most of the things I have most loved or hated, and that the Catholic faith nourished me and taught me all the little that I knew. Okay, so with those provisos out of the way, let's move to considering what's Catholic in the Lord of the Rings. And here let me suggest that the Catholic vision of the Lord of the Rings can be appreciated at both kind of a meta level and a down-on-the-ground micro level. So this talk is going to remain, for the most part, at the meta level, though concrete examples will be offered to put flesh and bones on what I'll be suggesting. I hope you've read the story, because if not, lots of spoilers coming your way, or at least, you know, if you watch the movies. If not, well, you've been warned. So at the furthest meta level, say if we kind of zoomed out at 30,000 feet, what we find in The Lord of the Rings is a presentation of good and evil, of beauty and ugliness, of nobility and indecency or wickedness, of excellence of character, especially moral excellence, and corruption of character, that is clearly born of and shaped by a Christian, that is, Catholic worldview. Tolkien's vision of beauty, truth, goodness, nobility, virtue, heroism is a Catholic one. As a Christian, for instance, Tolkien knows what virtuous and good character, seen most especially, of course, in the saints, looks like. And so he presents to us numerous models of heroism, who are paragons of virtue, of nobility, of bearing hardship, especially for others, of courage, of self-sacrificial love, of high purpose, of beauty, of self-possession, of measured self-control and prudential action. Consider the list of candidates: Aragorn, Frodo, Sam, Gandalf, Legolas, Gimli, Faramir, Theoden, Éomer, Galadriel, Eowyn, etc., and the list goes on. In this connection, one of the things that I ask my students at the end of the course that I teach on Tolkien is to pick their favorite character. Now, the choices are always varied, but they're always from this list. And if we find ourselves drawn to so many of the great and noble characters of The Lord of the Rings, it's because, as Tolkien well knows, we are at bottom drawn to goodness, beauty, truth, heroism, and love. because we're wired for these things. Christian faith makes clear we are charged by God for the good, for truth and beauty, which explains why we are decidedly not drawn to evil and wickedness, to ugliness, to pride, to betrayal, to falsehood, to cowardice, or to hate, even if we have a fascination with it. For which reason, none of my students ever picks as their favorite character Gollum, or Sauron, or Saruman, or Grishnak the Orc, or Shelob, or the Witch King, or even the tragic figures of Denethor or Boromir. It is telling how, in a letter, Tolkien acknowledged that The Lord of the Rings recounts a story that can be, quote, cast in terms of a good side and a bad side. Beauty against ruthless tyranny, ugliness. Tyranny against kingship, moderated freedom with consent against compulsion. On the issue of ruthless ugliness and tyranny, we should note that as a Christian, Tolkien knows evil is real, that it exists, and that there are wicked spirits, demons, seeking our destruction. There is such a thing as malice and revenge, Gandalf says to Frodo in the Fellowship of the Ring. Indeed, there is, and the biblical witness makes clear that we find it in all free, that is, rational and moral creatures, both pure spirits, angels, and incarnate spirits, human beings. Tolkien believes in evil. He believes in the devil. That is, he believes in both human malice and fallen angelic malice. And we should not be surprised to find something of the like in The Lord of the Rings. Okay, on then to very structural themes of The Lord of the Rings that I think flow from a thoroughly Catholic imagination. The first would be the Eucharist. In a letter to his son, Tolkien says this about the Eucharist. There, in the Eucharist, you will find romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all your loves upon earth. Later, he confesses how he, quote, fell in love with the Blessed Sacrament from the beginning, and by the mercy of God, never have fallen out again. He counseled his son, Christopher, upon his son's being called up into the Royal Air Force to serve in World War II, to know by heart the canon of the Mass, as this would allow him to say the Mass in your heart if ever hard circumstances should keep you from hearing Mass. We shouldn't be surprised, then, to see echoes or likenesses of the Eucharist all throughout The Lord of the Rings. Now, we see this most obviously in the case of Lembas, the elven whey bread, which is, quote, more strengthening than any food made by men. That's a quotation from Farewell to Lorien and the Fellowship of the Ring. The Eucharist, of course, is our whey bread, Viaticum. You know, this is one of the titles for the Eucharist, but Viaticum when it's given on one's deathbed. The Eucharist is our way bread while we are wayfarers in this life. In a letter, Tolkien affirms that Lembas has a, quote, religious significance that is above and beyond its relatively unimportant ability to give endurance of long marches with little provision, and that no analysis in any laboratory would discover chemical properties of Lembas that made it superior to other cakes of whole meal. For any informed Catholic, this language of religious significance beyond chemical analysis is so obviously code for the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation, since a chemical analysis of the Eucharist would also show it to be identical to bread. This is because a chemical analysis is only measuring the accidents as the substance, in this case, the substance of Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity. It's beyond sense detection. But we also see Eucharistic-like resonance in the table fellowship that is omnipresent in the story, particularly pronounced in those meals that satisfy deep longing because following upon intense combat with evil. And the deep longing that these meals satisfy is not simply that born of physical need for sustenance, but deeper social, that is rational or spiritual need for the pleasure, the enjoyment, and the fellowship provided by meals. Animals only eat. They don't have meals. Only rational animals have meals. Meals bespeak our humanity at its most basic and at its most elevated levels. And it is this deeper human need for meals, the need for the satisfaction of human needs at multiple levels amidst a life of suffering and hardship that the Eucharist meets. John 6:55, "For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed." So it begins with a generous supper provided by Farmer Meggett and his wife of good food. Quote, "a mighty dish of mushrooms and bacon, besides much other solid farmhouse fare." I'm glad I'm saying bacon on Friday of the octave of Easter, when meat is allowed fully, in fact, not only allowed, but encouraged to be consumed. And good conversation, fellowship, as Frodo, Sam, and Pippin make their way to Bree while being pursued by the Black Riders. The table fellowship continues next with a wonderful meal at the house of Tom Bombadil, a long and merry meal, after being rescued from Old Man Willow in the forest. Then, while the hobbits make their way to Rivendell with Strider and discover that they are running low on food, it is Strider who tells the hobbits to, quote, "think with hope of the tables of Elrond's house." And so this runs all throughout the story. And don't forget the stew that Sam made with the rabbits that Gollum had procured in Two Towers, ending with the festal banquet of great rejoicing and merriment after Frodo and Sam's rescue from Mount Doom. What Tolkien is showcasing here, allow me to suggest, is more than simply a Eucharistic sensibility, but a fuller Catholic, incarnational, or sacramental sensibility. Such a sensibility embraces and enjoys to the full the simplest and most ordinary of earthly goods, whether food, drink, a hot bath, a comfortable bed to sleep in, or even pipeweed, to Jews' examples from throughout The Lord of the Rings. Since, in a sacramental lens on the world, these can occasion encounters with no one less than God himself. A sacramental imagination, particularly one that finds in the sacramental meal of the Eucharist romance, glory, honor, fidelity, and the true way of all one's loves upon earth, that's again Tolkien's words, might well account for the importance of meals and table fellowship in The Lord of the Rings. A second structural theme would be that of elevated or exalted womanhood. Tolkien presents us in The Lord of the Rings with several female figures. Think, for instance, of Lady Goldberry, Lady Galadriel, Lady Arwen, Lady Eowyn, who are among the very wise and powerful of Middle-earth, and who stand toe-to-toe with their male counterparts, yet without losing their feminine identity. So if we can speak of a feminism in Tolkien, we must be quick to distinguish it from secular feminism that would overspread Western culture half a century after the writing of The Lord of the Rings, a feminism that turns equality into sameness, and thus where we see no real differences between men and women, especially biological differences, as of course we see being played out in our very culture today. It's more feminism that Pope John Paul II spoke of, say, in his apostolic letter on the dignity of women, Mulieris Dignitatem. In Tolkien's world, women, if fundamentally equal to men, remain no less women, complementary to men in biology, in disposition, and in social function. In this connection, Tolkien had a special fondness for the Gospel of Luke, because of the prominent role that Luke's gospel gives to women. What accounts for his sense of elevated womanhood? Certainly, first and foremost, we can look to the fact that Tolkien enjoyed the presence of strong and loving women in his own life. First, there was his mother, quote, "a gifted lady of great beauty and wit, who suffered persecution of her Catholic faith. She was a convert." He says of her in a letter to his son. Second, his wife, Edith Bratt. His love affair with Edith was the model for that of Beren and Lúthien and of Aragorn and Arwen. But more remotely, this is accounted for by his Catholic faith, which holds up countless women as models of spiritual heroism and excellence. There is Mary and Martha of Bethany and Mary Magdalene of the New Testament. And then, to choose only a few examples, Catherine of Siena, Prater of the Papacy and Doctor of the Church, Teresa of Avila, visionary, great reformer of the Carmelite order, also doctor of the church. Thérèse of Lisieux, popular saint of the 20th century, doctor of the church as well. There's also Bernadette Subaru, visionary of Lourdes, whom Tolkien had a special devotion to and whom he found utterly remarkable. There's also Joan of Arc, Can we not see an obvious parallel between Lady Eowyn, Shield Maiden of Rohan, and Joan of Arc? But most especially, of course, there is the Virgin Mary. Nothing has captured the Catholic imagination more than the beauty, the holiness, the power, the womanhood, the grace, the nobility of the Mother of God. Tolkien says this, he says that to the Virgin Mary he owes, quote, all my own small perception of beauty, both in majesty and simplicity. As regards Lady Galadriel, Tolkien affirms that the Catholic devotion to Mary is at the source of her character, particularly as described, quote, through the words of Gimli and Sam. And if we return to Lady Eowyn, seeing beyond a connection between her and Joan of Arc, do we not also see a parallel between her in her confrontation with the Witch King and the Virgin Mary, who crushes the head of the serpent? A third structural theme would be that of friendship. Recall that, according to Christian faith, human salvation is accomplished by means of friendship. No longer do I call you servants, but I've called you friends, says Jesus at the Last Supper, which we celebrated a week ago, right after saying, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. In this connection, consider the crucial role that friendship plays in The Lord of the Rings. The friendship among the hobbits. It would be well to trust rather to their friendship, says Gandalf to Elrond, of Merry and Pippin's desire to go on the quest just after the Council of Elrond. There's the friendship among the Fellowship of the Nine, the friendship between Gimli and Legolas, the friendship between Aragorn and Gandalf, and most especially the friendship between Frodo and Sam. It is by the friendship of Frodo and Sam especially that Middle-earth is saved, of course. But the particular form of friendship that I'd like to focus on, because it acts as a throughout the whole story, is what St. Thomas Aquinas, following the biblical witness, especially Genesis, calls highest friendship, maxima amicitia, marriage. Tolkien has an extremely high estimation of marriage, an elevated view of marriage, one that is very strong in biblical resonance and deeply attractive for its power, its romance, and beauty. He threads various marital relationships, either already married or clearly ordered to marriage, throughout the story, and in each instance we are drawn to them for their beauty, their romantic quality, their power of complementarity, where husband and wife are clearly equal yet distinct. Beginning with Tom Bombadil and Lady Goldberry, recall that Tom calls Lady Goldberry his, quote, pretty lady, and he dotes on her by picking lilies for her. He wakes her by singing under her his window. And we're given a beautiful domestic image of the two of them preparing and serving supper for the hobbits, as if the text says, weaving a single dance. What marriage can't relate to the experience of distinct roles working in harmony toward the common good of a family unit at mealtime than this dance? There's Lord Celeborn and Lady Galadriel of Lothlorien, Aragorn and Arwen. Recall these two recapitulate the love of Beren and Lúthien, who are themselves modeled after Tolkien and his wife Edith. And they suffer through great trial and tribulation in the proving of their deep love for each other. In private, Tolkien confirmed that the, quote, highest love story in The Lord of the Rings is that of Aragorn and Arwen, Elrond's daughter. There's Faramir and Eowyn. This love story, which is showcased near the end of the story, is a beautiful and tender one. With its multiple garden references, its nobility and near royalty of language and courtesy, its bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh-like longing, and what Faramir expresses for Eowyn, and for the fact that they are both starting their lives anew, this tale offers clear echoes of our first parents, of prelapsarian Adam and Eve in the garden, presented as Lord and Lady, King and Queen of Eden. This is, in fact, true as well of Tom Bombadil and Lady Goldberry, of Lord Celeborn and Lady Galadriel, of Aragorn and Arwen, and likewise of Beren and Lúthien. And let's not forget that The Lord of the Rings closes, like the Bible does, with the image of marriage and family. It's the wedding supper of the Lamb and the adorning of the heavenly Jerusalem as the bride of Christ in the case of the Bible, the wedding of Aragorn and Arwen, and Sam's returning home to Rosie and his family in the case of the Lord of the Rings. The very last words of the Lord of the Rings belong to Sam. I'm back. What is he back to? But home. Home to his wife and daughter. Some, you know, criticize Tolkien for putting marriage on a pedestal as a naive and romantic ideal that has little to do with the hard realities of married life. We might retort, is it Tolkien who puts marriage on an idealistic pedestal, or is it our culture, dominated by what Pope Benedict XVI once called a new philosophy of sexuality, that gets marriage so wrong and so badly, and so cheapens marriage and sells it short of the heights to which it can attain? Tolkien, we should point out, considered marriage as marking one of the devil's favorite targets. He mentions that in Letter 43. Catholic moral teaching, basing itself on the biblical witness, leaves little doubt. Marriage marks a bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh reality that God intends all married couples, along with the happiness and beauty that accompany it, to experience. We would do well, then, to heed and seek to imbibe in our own marriages Tolkien's high estimation of the romantic beauty and nobility of marriage. A fourth structural theme would be one that we could term anti-Pelagianism. And by it, Tolkien shows that he's a true spiritual master, a master of the spiritual life. Pelagianism is the heresy that holds that we can overcome evil on our own and resist it by our own willpower, that we can be virtuous and holy by our own power and might, that we can save ourselves, and that if we need God's help, it's only a little bit of help that's needed, not more. Catholic doctrine considers this a heresy, since our fallen condition means, at bottom, that we are in truth powerless over evil and sin, and that we stand in need of help to overcome sin, especially within ourselves. At the heart of this teaching is, of course, the doctrine of original sin, whereby it is understood that human nature is fundamentally disordered, out of whack, or off kilter, that we are our own worst enemies, and that this is traceable to our first parents. Tolkien, for his part, was keenly attuned to this aspect of Catholic teaching, as it was deeply formative of his understanding of good and evil, of divine grace, free will, and the like. One finds a pronounced Augustinian anti-Pelagian strain in his letters, in that he continually lays stress on the fallen world in which we live. In one letter, he writes, "The power of evil in the world is not finally resistible by incarnate creatures, however good." Not surprisingly, then, we find a pronounced anti-Pelagian spirit running throughout the Lord of the Rings, I would say, both in the inability of good incarnate creatures to resist evil on their own, and in the corresponding necessity of divine grace to conquer evil, what St. Thomas Aquinas calls the grace of auxilium. Grace is that unmerited assistance given by God that breaks in when things look bleakest to dispel the power of darkness and evil. In this connection, Tolkien confirms in private correspondence that grace does indeed appear in mythological forms in the Lord of the Rings. One simple example of such a mythical form of grace, and which occurs early on in the story, I would suggest, is when Frodo and the hobbits are imprisoned and caught hopelessly, these are the words of the text, by the Barrow-wights. Like us who call upon God or the saints for help, Frodo has the presence of mind to call upon Tom Bombadil. The text then says this: "There was a loud rumbling sound, as of stone rolling and falling, and suddenly light streamed in, real light, the plain light of day." Just juxtapose the account of the resurrection in Matthew's gospel alongside this passage to see the biblical resonance in it. The Pelagian poster boy, or the archetype of Pelagianism in the story, is, I think it's obvious, Boromir, and perhaps even to a greater extent his father, Lord Denethor. Of note, Appendix A of The Lord of the Rings describes Boromir as like his father Denethor in pride, a pride that the appendix notes led Denethor to, quote, trust in his own strength of will. By daring to contest evil in ways that none of his predecessors had dared to do. And Boromir, for his part, and not coincidentally, is qualified as tall and proud when he's introduced into the story at the Council of Elrond. Tolkien intends this qualification of Boromir as tall and proud to serve, I think, as a Pelagian red flag, as it sets up what Boromir will say of the ring at the Council. Why should we not think that the Great Ring has come into our hands to serve us in this very hour of need? Wielding it, the free lords of the free may surely defeat the enemy. Let the ring be your weapon if it has such power as you say. The Lord of the Rings makes little sense, of course, if the ring doesn't have a much deeper significance, whereby it represents evil and sin as disordered attachment to created goods, or in this case, power. Very early on, Gandalf observes how the ring takes possession of the one who has it, which is indeed what happens to Gollum and to Bilbo, and of course to Boromir, and eventually to Frodo. Hence the Pelagian folly of Boromir's desire to wield the ring to defeat the enemy, a folly that reaches its zenith in his final confrontation with Frodo. He betrays Pelagian-like pride when he says, "We of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial, and we desire only strength to defend ourselves, strength in a just cause. It is mad not to use the ring, to use the power of the enemy against him." And we know what follows. This anti-Pelagian undercurrent that runs throughout the story reaches its apogee in what I would call the great anti-Pelagian scene in all of Western literature. It's Frodo's inability to arrive at the crack of Mount Doom without external help, Sam's help, followed by his inability to cast the ring into the fire of Mount Doom, and the ring's destruction via outside help, without auxilium. "I do not choose to do now what I came to do," Frodo says at the very crack of Mount Doom. "I will not do this deed. The ring is mine." Then, after the ring's destruction, Frodo says to Sam, "Do you remember Gandalf's words? Even Gollum may have something yet to do. But for him, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring." In his addressing the Frodo fail in private correspondence, Tolkien writes, quote, "It is possible for the good, even saintly, to be subjected to a power of evil which is too great for them to overcome in themselves." And in support, he cites 1 Corinthians 10:12, "Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall." And he expressly calls Gollum's intervention a grace. Gollum's betrayal was a grace since it came at a precise juncture when the final evil deed was the most beneficial thing anyone could have done for Frodo. Fifth structural theme is what I would call gospel-like pity. Mercy, forgiveness. In a letter, Tolkien confesses, "The exercise of pity, mercy, and forgiveness of injury underpinned the logic of the story. A logic that was determined," and get this highly significant remark, "by the," quote, "writer of the story, by which I do not mean myself, that one ever-present person who is never absent, never named," capital P, person, capital W, writer. Elsewhere, he confesses that while he was writing The Lord of the Rings, he felt throughout that I was not inventing, but reporting. The model for the exercise of forgiveness is, of course, Jesus himself on the cross. Particularly when, Tolkien observes, Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Who embodies this pity, mercy, forgiveness? Bilbo? Gandalf, Sam, Frodo. Towards the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, in a conversation between Gandalf and Frodo, Frodo exclaims that it was, quote, "a pity that Bilbo did not stab that vile creature Gollum when he had the chance." To this, Gandalf famously replies, "Pity? It was pity that stayed his hand. Pity and mercy. My heart tells me that Gollum has some part to play yet, for good or ill, before the end, And when that comes, the pity of Bilbo may rule the fate of many, yours not least. As we know, Frodo will eventually show the same pity toward Gollum. But before we get to Frodo, Sam will also show the same pity before Mount Doom, which is really more remarkable given Sam's suspicion of and hostility toward Gollum throughout the story. So let us read the passage concerning Sam. Sam's hand wavered. His mind was hot with wrath and the memory of evil. It would be just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature, just and many times deserved. And also, it seemed the only safe thing to do. But deep in his heart, there was something that restrained him. He could not strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, utterly wretched. He himself, though only for a little while, had borne the ring, and now, dimly he guessed the agony of Gollum's shriveled mind and body, enslaved to that ring, unable to find peace or relief ever in life again. Deep in his heart, what else could this be but pity, mercy, forgiveness? And it is difficult not to hear echoing in Sam's, having experienced the agony that comes with bearing the ring, this well-known passage from the letter to the Hebrews. For we have not a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sinning. Hebrews 4:15. Then, of course, there is Frodo's Christ-like forgiveness of Gollum. Recall the key line uttered by Frodo to Sam as Mount Doom was exploding. But for Gollum, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring. The quest would have been in vain, even at the bitter end. So let us forgive him. So let us forgive him. It is because Frodo forgives Gollum that Frodo is extravagantly generous toward Gollum, to use Tolkien's words, that Middle Earth can be saved. A sixth and last structural theme that I'll mention, and perhaps the most important since the whole story turns on it, is the Pauline notion of folly, the folly of the cross, made famous in 1 Corinthians. So let us read the passage. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it pleased God, through the folly of what we preach, to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. As St. Paul sees it, the cross confronts us with a folly of salvation accomplished not simply in a completely unforeseen manner, but in a manner that smacks against human wisdom, a manner that, at least at first sight, strikes one as foolish. Holding up a dead man on a cross as our Savior, indeed, seems like a purely foolish absurdity. Crucifixion marks a cursed death according to Jewish law, and a heinous penal death of the most gruesome, torturous sort according to Roman law. It's the ultimate sign of human weakness and ineptitude, of human limitation, finitude, the exclamation point, as it were, on our being pinned under the thumb of death, and thus of our inability to be our own Savior. And therein lies the key, according to St. Paul, since if we're saved through a death by crucifixion, it can only be by God's power and might, not our own. There's no way we can take the least bit credit for our salvation. Thus, St. Paul recognizes a higher wisdom at work in Christ's death, a divine wisdom, even if on a purely human level it strikes as folly. In this connection, we can recall the words of Isaiah, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." As for the Lord of the Rings, the very quest to destroy the ring is modeled after this Pauline notion of divine folly. the evidence for it comes in the very language that Gandalf uses in pitching the idea of the quest at the Council of Elrond, almost as if it were St. Paul himself making this pitch, which we see when juxtaposing Gandalf's words alongside the 1 Corinthians passage. Gandalf says, "It is wisdom to recognize necessity when all other courses have been weighed, though as folly it may appear to those who cling to false hope." Well, let folly be our cloak, a veil before the eyes of the enemy. Gandalf repeats this language when he, in Two Towers, after he has the resurrected Gandalf has reappeared to Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli and Fangorn Forest. Sauron supposes that we, the Fellowship, were all going to Minas Tirith, for that is what he himself would have done in our place. And according to his wisdom, it would have been a heavy stroke against his power. That we should try to destroy the ring itself has not yet entered into his darkest dream. Wise fool. Wise fool. It's a deliciously brilliant Pauline turn of phrase. The word folly reoccurs several times in the remainder of the story, and it always has this Pauline ring, most notably in Gandalf's contest with Lord Denethor, where Denethor constantly refers to Gandalf as fool and gray fool. And when the Lord of the Nazgul, in his final showdown with Gandalf at the Siege of Gondor, says to the wizard, "Old fool," the irony is thicker than the neck of the Lord of the Nazgul's winged beast, the Lord of Carrion. Gandalf's final Pauline pitch comes when he counsels a final assault on the Black Gates to draw Sauron's attention away from Mount Doom. He says, in the midst of making this pitch, "Sauron's eye is now straining towards us, blind almost to all else that is moving. So we must keep it. We have not the ring. In wisdom or great folly, it has been sent away to be destroyed, lest it destroy us. Without it, we cannot by force defeat his force. But we must at all costs keep his eye from his true peril. We cannot achieve victory by arms, but by arms we can give the ring-bearer his only chance, frail though it be." The final appearance of the Pauline notion of folly comes significantly enough at the climax of the story when Frodo puts on the ring at the crack of Mount Doom. The text reads, "Far away, as Frodo put on the ring and claimed it for his own, even in the very heart of his realm, the power in Barad-dûr was shaken, and the tower trembled from its foundations to its proud and bitter crown. The Dark Lord was suddenly aware of him, and his eye, piercing all shadows, looked across the plain to the door that he had made. And the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash, and all the devices of his enemies were at last laid bare." The takeaway line here obviously is, the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash. Tolkien might easily also have written, "The magnitude of the wisdom of the quest was revealed to him in a blinding flash." Or, "The foolishness of God is wiser than men, so the foolishness of the quest is wiser than Sauron." Okay, that's what I have for you. I've barely scratched the surface. For instance, I've not even mentioned how Gandalf is a Christ the prophet-like character, the one who speaks with a higher knowledge and higher wisdom, how Frodo is a Christ the priest-type figure, the one who shoulders the cross and who offers himself up for the salvation of Middle-earth, or how Aragorn is a Christ the king-type figure, the king who has a first coming in obscurity, simplicity, humility, poverty, and a second coming in glory and majesty amidst great fanfare. But I hope to have helped bear out what Tolkien meant when he called The Lord of the Rings a fundamentally Catholic work. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.